Hi, everyone. My name is Mo Bhandari. I'm editor-in-chief of Ortho Evidence, and we have a great orthopod today with two investigators who have really spearheaded a critically important problem. The group is called the No Pain Investigators, and they're going to share with you insights from a recent publication of the Journal of the American Medical Association, published October 4th of 2022. We have Drs. Aaron Gazentam and Dr. Separek Thierry. Welcome, both.
Thanks, Mo.
Thanks for having us.
So, Aaron, I wonder if you might, as principal investigator and lead for this particular trial, share with us a little bit about what you found. And I might then ask Sepper if you, to talk a little bit about the implications of this work. It's certainly a fascinating trial, but also goes a lot to, what the implications may be as we go forward. So, Aaron, maybe you could speak to us a little bit about what this trial was about.
Sure. Yeah. So the background and kind of the idea for the trial was that there's growing evidence that opioid sparing approaches for postoperative pain management are becoming more recognized and effective, particularly in orthopedic surgery, where there's been a real push to move away from opioids in that postoperative period. But there's really been a lack of large scale trials. So the idea of our trial was to look at all patients undergoing shoulder and knee arthroscopy and then evaluate an opioid sparing approach to their postoperative pain management compared to the standard of care right now in North America, which is an opioid for pain management after surgery. And so we randomized 200 patients to either an opioid sparing group or the standard of care group. And then we evaluated how many opioids they took postoperatively, as well as their pain levels and patient satisfaction. And so we found a significant reduction.
If I could just stop you before that, could you speak a little bit about what the opioid sparing approaches were? Because I think that would be a critical to understanding of what this intervention is.
Yeah, so it was a multimodal approach. So we gave patients a prescription for an anti-inflammatory, which for most patients that was naproxen, as well as acetaminophen. Then we gave them a small prescription for an opioid as a rescue prescription in case they had increased levels of pain. And then we also provided patients with a patient education infographic, just providing them a little bit more information on when and how to take medications and other adjuncts to help manage their pain postoperatively.
Great, thank you. Okay, and you found using this strategy, what?
Yeah, so we found a significant reduction in the amount of opioids consumed within 6 weeks after surgery. So the median consumption actually in the opioid sparing group was zero. So a significant amount of patients actually didn't use any of that rescue opioid medications compared to a median consumption of 40 milligrams of opioid or oral morphine equivalents in the standard of care group.
Can I ask you a question just on that as well? Is your control group comparable to other control groups? For example, in randomized trials, there's always that psychology that, well, when you're being tested, everything gets a bit lower and they're part of a no pain study. They're probably aware of that. Or was your control group morphine equivalents comparable to what, sort of patients not in the trial would have usually used?
Yeah, no, that's a good point, because I think that, you have an inclusion bias of anybody who's willing to be randomized to having a non-opioid strategy after surgery would be probably more amenable to using less opioids.
Yeah.
That's a good point. So maybe even less of a difference than we might see in the real world.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, that's good. So, I mean, it's suggestive what you're saying, that there may be even a greater difference from routine practice, mm-hmm. because being involved in a trial often leads people to change behavior to some extent, even though you still found a pretty significant difference, which is impressive.
If I can jump in, just to add to that, one thing we did do to control at least the surgeon variability is we asked all the surgeons that were involved what their standard of care prescription was, because we didn't want them to start changing as they started to see where the trial was going. And so we did standardize at least that part of it to control for a bit of that.
And can you speak a little bit? So before I jump into some other broader questions, is there anything else, Aaron, regarding key outcomes? So obviously there's considerably less opioid. Was there any other outcomes of interest, any other complications associated with maybe using multimodal? NSAIDs certainly aren't benign, but I'm just curious if there was any other issues.
Yeah, so we also looked at the amount prescribed, which obviously that was going to be lower in the opioid sparing group. But the mean amount prescribed in the standard of care group was 340 milligrams of oral morphine equivalents compared to 40 in our opioid sparing group. But I think importantly, there was no difference in patient pain at any time point in that 6 weeks postoperatively, and there was no difference in patient satisfaction with regards to their pain control. And then finally, I think an important part for both prescribers and for patients, there was no difference in the amount of patients who required a refill of their opioids after their initial prescription.
Yeah, so it seems like a pretty compelling storyline. I mean, what does this mean for practicing surgeons globally with the use of this approach? It seems like it's and cost-wise, I'm presuming this is significantly, I presume would be more cost-effective than using standard. So it doesn't seem to be a reason why you wouldn't adopt this. How should practice change because of the study, Sepper?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I kind of would break the implications down into three main points. And the first one, which really was very important for me after seeing the results, is that patients will take basically as much opioids as you prescribe. And I'm sure part of that effect is because, you know, it's on the prescription and they think they're being prescribed a medication because they need that amount. And so the fact that the reduction in prescription and the reduction in consumption was parallel, I think, is a very important point. I think, you know, sometimes we may think I'll just give them some extra just in case, but they probably won't take it if they don't need it. I think that's a really important thing for surgeons to keep in mind. The second thing is, you know, this is an intervention that is very cost effective. It was very cheap to implement with, you know, a simple infographic and some standardized prescriptions. And actually, it didn't result in any increase in the amount of burden on the surgeons. And we thought that was an important thing, which may be a barrier to adoption. And so we measured that to make sure that, you know, these patients weren't calling in asking for refills all the time. And we showed that that wasn't the case. So given that we know, you know, we can reduce both the amount prescribed, so the amount that's out there for, you know, for diversion or harm to children and families, the fact that we can reduce the amount consumed by our patients, and the fact that it really doesn't increase the burden on the surgeon's office, I think, you know, there's very little reason not to adopt this in this population and then to expand this work to other populations and to find similar solutions.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I find fascinating is that the approach you use, right? I mean, the fact that you reduce the opioids, you give a smaller prescription, which gets to the idea that, you know, patients possibly, you know, if you give them more, we'll take more, believing that that's, you know, that's what's recommended. So giving them less may just say, okay, that's what I need. Changing it to an NSAID, which is interesting and important. But I think also the idea of the infographic is an important one. I mean, there's so many elements to the intervention. And do you have a sense of which was the driver? Like, for example, the surgeon priming the patient to say, I don't believe that you're going to need this much. I'm going to prescribe you this, you know, an NSAID. This should be more than enough for you. And by the way, here is, you know, some additional information for you, you know, with respect to some other information. That already seems like a lot more than someone who would standardly just prescribe an opioid. Do you have a sense of any of those, just from your own experience, is one of the drivers of that? I mean, is it the fact that, you know, that you're doing much more interaction and providing much more information to patients as one of the key drivers of just them reducing?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously it's hard to say objectively because we didn't measure that, but just based on, you know, my experiences in residency, I think you make a great point. And that was part of the reason we came up with this infographic, because the number of times where, you know, before this trial started, where I'd be talking to a patient about their post-operative script, which we don't always get a chance to do in person, but telling them, you know, you can't, these are the medications you can take, and these are the ones you can actually take at the same time. And these ones interact, these ones don't. You know, we assume that patients know that information, but a lot of times they don't. So I found a lot of patients were surprised to hear that they could take, you know, if they had no other contraindications, they could take acetaminophen and an anti-inflammatory and their opioid medication in kind of a staged fashion. Right. And also, I think there's the, you know, natural effect of we give so much information to patients verbally, and then they go home and they kind of remember maybe a few salient points, but it's a really big deal, and it's information overload. And so having something they can go home and look at and say, oh yeah, I remember this conversation, and something to reinforce it. I think that probably made a big difference. I don't know what you think, Aaron.
Yeah, I think another point that's important is anti-inflammatories are a very powerful analgesic, which we know, you know, from numerous level one studies. So I think the addition of that is as kind of the forefront of our pharmacologic pain management was important. And, you know, they do have a side effect profile, but we actually measured the amount of adverse events, but as well as we measured patient reported side effects. And the opioid group actually had a significantly higher rate of side effects than the opioid sparing group, because opioids, you know, come with their own side effects like nausea, vomiting, right, constipation.
So maybe, you know, more a little on the lighter side, but also a critically important one. How did you come up with this idea? Now, I know, you know, Aaron, you're still in your training, and you're a principal investigator of a very important trial. I recall that you had presented this work as part of what we call a first cut. It was an innovation forum, which was a small amount of money given. Can you speak a little bit about to the sort of the origins of the idea and how you were able to cobble together the funding to put together, which I believe absolutely is a practice-changing trial?
Yeah, I don't know if I can take full credit for the actual origin of the idea, but one of our other co-investigators, Nolan Horner, who's now practicing in Chicago, I think may have been the originator of the idea. But I think what the three of us wanted to do is really come up with a high level of evidence and something that was feasible within as a resident, and something that would be practice changing. And I think, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is like one of those classic examples. I mean, for those listening in and those who are residents listening in, I mean, you know, we often feel as a trainee that, you know, you don't have the opportunity to do practice changing research, and we're often scrambling for ideas. What I love about this is that, you know, fundamentally three residents in training worked together and then garnered the additional mentorship support from others in the faculty. But really, this is a resident run trial for the most part. And it just goes to the point is that, you know, at any level, you can have great ideas and you can come up with good designs and thoughtful designs and rally the troops, so to speak, around you to be able to put together something in a meaningful way. I mean, this is very rare, but I think it's a great example of what can be accomplished when, you know, you work together. But I'm sure you've got some other thoughts on this. And it's a huge congratulations to you, all three of you, and obviously and the rest of the investigative team who were critically important to ensuring you as trainees had the appropriate mentorship to move this forward.
Yeah, I think that it was really an iterative process. I think the original idea compared to the final product, it went through many many revisions, and the peer review process in terms of getting grants and everything was really helpful in that. And so I think, you know, we started out with an idea, and I think the important part is that you're flexible, because certainly our original idea was very different than the end result. I think probably more effective because we had all the support from Dr. Annie, as well as all the peer review that was performed with the grants, really strengthened the methodology of the study.
Right. And can you speak just a little bit to the sort of the first few grants you had and what sort of amount you received, and more so just to help others understand that in the world right now where randomized trials can cost multiple millions of dollars, great practice changing work can still happen with committed investigators with slightly more frugal budgets. And I anticipate this was not a multi-million dollar budget. Although I'm sure you would have loved it to be one.
But yeah. Well, I don't know that leather chair that separates. I don't know.
I do see an Austin Powers Dr. Evil looking chair there, but I mean, I didn't want to comment on that. That would be a distraction from the importance of this chair.
The leather bound books.
I'm not looking for the kitten or the cat.
It's out of view. It's down here.
It's out of view. Yes. Anyway, sorry, Aaron.
Yeah, no, I think the very first grant we got was through McMaster Department of Surgery, which was the first cut competition, which is kind of like early incubator type ideas that you have.
Was it 500 or I think we
wanted I think it was a yeah maybe $1,000. So yeah, we started with 1,000, and then we I think Nolan received the new investigator grant from Hamilton Health Sciences, which was which was a $50,000 grant. And then we also received the PSI resident grant for about 30,000, and that was it.
Yeah.
And so then we kind of went from there.
Yeah. I mean, an impressive amount. And ultimately, a lot of this is work, right? It's people putting in high quality effort and time. And this gets back to the collaborative effort that this trial was. So, you know,
what's the caveat? I will say the caveat to that is that we did have great, you know, mentorship from Dr. Annie and his infrastructure that was already in place, having run multiple trials. We would not have been able to do it without the whole team that he has.
So there's in-kind support for sure that we're not talking about, but principally, you know, just a great collaborative effort and, you know, certainly, you know, something that I think we should all be thinking about. And, you know, I guess the question is that you've had such a great, successful interaction. What's next for you three? Please tell me you're not breaking up the dream team. I mean, you have to do more, I hope.
Dream team's together for a long time.
Hopefully. Excellent.
Yeah, I think, you know, and it's interesting because we all kind of have some overlapping career interests, but also some divergent ones, which is perfect because, you know, this kind of came about as we were all mid-level trainees and now we're heading into early staff careers. And so, you know, I think the next step is to see where we can take this research next into other subspecialties and into other, perhaps even other surgical specialties, because, you know, while we're focused on orthopedics, this is a pan medical problem, but definitely across the surgical spectrum as well. And so I think, you know, the next step is, and I know there's already some work at McMaster with arthroplasty. So, you know, seeing how our results can inform that project and future projects.
Yeah, I can see your vision statement now, a world with no pain, no pain investigators. I love it. I love it, guys. Anyways, on that note, a huge thank you to both Aaron Gazanem, Sepehr Akhtiari, and the remainder of the No Pain Investigative team for sharing a little bit of time with us and giving us some insight into a very important practice-changing trial. Thank you again, gentlemen.
Thank you.